Hello and welcome back to Last Orders. I'm Tom Slater, editor of Spiked, joined by my co-host Chris Snowden. How are you doing, Chris?
Very well indeed. Thank you, Tom. I hope you are too, listeners.
And we're also delighted to be joined on the show today by Reem Ibrahim, who's one of Chris's colleagues here at the Institute of Economic Affairs. How are you doing, Reem?
Hello, I'm well. How are you both?
Very well. It's been a hell of a 24 hours in politics.
We're recording this on Wednesday, listeners.
Yes. So whilst we are, of course, going to get into the latest nanny state news, we would be remiss if we didn't talk a bit, Chris, about the US election. It felt like, particularly with COVID, the banter era of politics was kind of put on hold. Has it come roaring back with the fact that Donald Trump is on his way back to the White House, also seems to have conquered all before him in terms of the Senate and the popular vote and who knows what? You know, he's completely spun out the kind of restless politics view of the world. Is the banter era coming back?
Possibly. I hope so. Thing you can never really go back. I don't think these things are never as good the second time around. It probably won't be as funny. He's not on Twitter as much.
That's true.
It's probably not going to be quite as chaotic. I think maybe he's got a bit of a handle on what he needs to do. We haven't got Jeremy Corbyn around, who was a key player in the banter era as well. Of course, I think the banter era was a unique moment in history, and we'll never really understand why it happened or why it ended. But it's certainly fun to watch. I didn't see the election. I kind of wish I'd stayed up and watched it now, particularly the rest of his politics episode.
Yeah.
And indeed the Channel 4 coverage. Because I've been catching up on Twitter, and there seems a lot of strong content, particularly on the rest of his policy.
Well, there was just so much moaning. I mean, that's literally what it was. It was moaning from both of them for absolutely hours.
Being schooled by Dominic Sambrook,
yes.
Which is the best bit from a much better podcast. Do you know, just a quick digression, you know, the rest is politics people did that show at the O2?
Yes.
It was like a sold out show, which in itself is unbelievable. Do you know how much the tickets were?
Nope.
£95.
That's absurd.
Talk about a fall in the money. £95. Lots of centrist dads.
Yeah.
Paying £95 quid to watch.
You can tell they've got a lot of disposable income.
War criminal.
I think that says a lot about the class base.
The middle class centrist dads in North London.
That's where the money is. We're in the wrong game. But anyway, rest of politics. Rory Stewart put out a tweet a few days ago saying he was very, very confident indeed.
Yeah.
100% sure, in fact, that Kamala Harris is going to win. Here are all the reasons why.
Comfortably.
And he's put money on it. Comfortably.
Yeah.
And he was looking forward to all the excuses people who predicted that Trump was going to win were going to make. Yeah. And at the time, I screenshotted it. I mean, I thought, this is a ridiculous thing.
Yeah, yeah.
In an election that everyone agrees is on a knife edge, the polls are pretty much 50-50. Why would you stake your reputation as a political commentator by making this prediction, which, if correct, people are going to forget.
Yeah.
But if wrong, you're never going to be allowed to forget. Such a silly thing to do. And so now he's been trying to weasel out of that and going like, well, yeah, it was Americans' fault for letting me down. And I'm just too nice a guy. I always think the best of people. And if people were as nice as I thought they were, Harris would have won. So in a way, I was right.
There you go.
That's so accurate. I think just the way that people like Rory Stewart, that kind of centrist dad mantra, where it is effectively, if you don't vote the way that I thought that you were going to vote, and effectively what it is they think that they are more in touch with the American people than they actually are. What I found fascinating is how much of those kind of centrist commentators were engaged with the US elections this year, seemingly out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. They had absolutely nothing to do with US politics over the last few years, weren't really commenting on Biden at all, except for, well, look how much of an amazing job he's doing. Mm-hmm. And now all of a sudden it's, oh, we absolutely bat for Harris at 100%. I think what's really interesting is there seems to be a bit of a lack of nuance with it. It's effectively, you know, they're both not ideal candidates, but clearly Harris is the best candidate without any kind of questioning about what Trump's time in the White House actually looked like, but also what it might look like in a sort of Trump 2.0. And most economists would probably agree that there wasn't anything terrible about Trump 1.0.
No, it was pretty good, really, on balance. I mean, the foreign policy was good. The economics of it were not, you know, IEA style economics necessarily, and neither him or Harris economically literate at all. And I'm not keen on all this tariff stuff he's going on about. But then Harris doesn't seem to understand the price mechanism, right? So there's nothing between them on that score. But the economy did well under Trump. Maybe that was just because of a huge amount of deficit borrowing, same as under Biden. But it did okay, and people felt better. And if hadn't been for COVID, I think most people think he would have got re-elected. So why these pundits, which, as you say, Reem, has Rory Stewart even been to America recently? Do you know what I mean? He's just thinking, well, I wanted people to vote for Harris, so yeah. I predicted that she'd win. What kind of political analysis is that?
They're like, oh, the unthinkable has happened. It was like, well, he was elected in 2016. Yeah. Like, that has happened.
And the polls were sort of 50-50.
Exactly. There were people who were
he was also the bookie's favourite.
This hasn't come out of the clear.
Yeah, there's only two people who could have won it. And it was one of them.
And it was one of them. There's a 50-50 chance here.
The unthinkable. I suppose a libertarian candidate could have. I don't know.
Well, and actually, the libertarian—I mean, I forgot his name now—but the libertarian candidate,
as many people,
but he's actually more normal than the rest of them. And I think what's really interesting,
it's so unusual.
I remember watching an old presidential debate for the primaries for the Libertarian Party.
Yeah, they're great.
And they are so entertaining. Yeah. Oh my god, they're brilliant.
Is that kind of where there's some kind of purity test around? This guy once said he's in favour of seatbelt laws,
and then they're all
driving licences.
Exactly. Driving licences.
License to drive your own damn car? What next? Well, a license to put bread in your own toaster?
Exactly that. So that particular debate, I think, just encapsulates the radical libertarian. However, the candidate this year was actually quite normal. Quite a normal, sort of, as normal as libertarians go. quite normal, which I think was interesting. And I know a couple of people that are around the sort of international liberty movement that did end up voting libertarian for the first time.
Good on them. We don't know who this guy's name is. I mean, probably got more
than
1%
of them.
I wonder how the Prohibition Party did. There's still a Prohibition Party.
Is there?
Mm. Still keep
that's a hell of a single issue thing to keep going.
Yeah.
But no, it's, we will be.
They'll probably win one, though, the way things are going, Tom.
Is that your attempt at a segue? Because it wouldn't
be a bad time.
There's plenty more to pick over here, but it is one of those things where.
What do you make of it, Tom? I want to hear your view on the election.
Well, I think it's just. Kind of, it feels like maybe this is too hasty to say, but that it's turned the page a little bit on this period in which people could dismiss the populism thing as like a blip. You could just try and delegitimize it. You can try and say this was because people just had their prejudices pricked or because they were manipulated by misinformation. The fact that Trump has come back from the sorts of deficit he's come back from, the fact that he was a convicted felon, the fact that he was, you know, someone who supposedly completely discredited himself throughout the whole January 6th thing, with good reason to a certain extent. But because people saw that demonization campaign, that attempt to get him via the law, and also just the complete attempt to ignore the issues that he raised, to pretend that there was nothing going on with the border, that there was nothing going on, the gaslighting that took place.
Yeah.
I think it's impossible now for people to pretend that those issues don't exist and those voters don't matter in the way they might have done previously.
Right.
So it's not to say that...
Did he win more votes than ever? Because I know he won the popular vote.
I'm not sure if it's more votes than ever, but he looks like he's on track to win the popular vote. Because last time was quite inflated by the amount of sort of... I mean, the turnout was unusually high last time around, so that might have...
He shows that people have had enough of the woke left, I would say. Maybe this is confirmation bias, but I mean... I think most people, even who voted Trump, would admit that this man has significant flaws. And if the Republicans could have found a better candidate, they would have been much happier voting for him. But like in most elections, you vote against the person you hate most. And Kamala Harris was, let's face it, she's an imbecile. You know, everyone accepted that up until the moment she suddenly became the candidate. Everyone was like, going, even Democrat voters were going like, the danger with Biden is he might die and Kamala Harris might become president. These are Democrat supporters were saying that. And then, of course, as soon as she ended up with a nomination, there was this sudden change of image in what's she's so, so slay and all this kind of
stuff. I've absolutely loved this. So Owen Jones tweeted this morning, sort of talking about the fact that he, when he was in the US and he was talking to a Pakistani cab driver who voted for Trump because the prices were too high under Biden. Yeah. It's so fascinating to me that so many of these particular commentators don't realise how patronising they really do come across, effectively saying that, you know, how awful it is. How dare a Pakistani cab driver vote for Trump? I mean, you cannot write this stuff. The identity politics, the obsession with identity politics is just so, so strong amongst these particular people. And they just can't believe that somehow somebody that looks like the minority that they are trying to protect or he's pretending to protect somehow doesn't agree with them politically.
But he did better with the minorities.
With the minorities,
and Harris did better with the whites, I think. Is that right?
Yeah, well, that's looked like it might... Not of the second half of that might not be true necessarily, but certainly amongst Hispanics,
doing better with the minorities is pretty good for a guy who supposedly is a Nazi, isn't it?
Absolutely, and that's been the story of the part of all three elections now is that he has slowly been building up his support, particularly amongst Hispanics, but also amongst African Americans. Like American politics was remarkably and quite alarmingly racially polarized before Trump came on the scene. And the bloke who's being smeared as a fascist and white supremacist, as you suggest, has almost single-handedly reversed that racial polarization and sent it in the other direction.
There is one point, if I, it's sort of a Sam Brookian point to kind of take things down a bit, really, mm-hmm. is that I think there's a massive inflation to incumbent effect here, for want mm-hmm. of a better phrase.
Oh, absolutely.
Which yeah. I can't think of any country which has re-elected whoever was in charge yeah. when all the lockdown inflation took mm-hmm. off. Starmer, obviously, in this country, you know, took over largely off the back of that, and other reasons too. But I think Spain had a change of government. Germans kind of had a change of government. Macron just about held on.
Yeah.
Trudeau looks like he's out the door, despite being terrifically popular. Yeah. Jacinda Ardern, who apparently was the most popular politician in the world, got hoofed out yeah. straight afterwards. I think the Aussies kicked out whoever was in charge. I could be wrong about that. They have an election every couple of years. And now the US has done mm-hmm. I mean, and Argentina did it. I mean, I just don't think, there's probably exceptions to this, but it seems to me that in nearly every case, whoever was in charge, either during COVID and or when mm-hmm. the inflation as a result with all the money printing during COVID took off, have been booted out.
Yeah.
So it is just a kind of possibly a case of it's the economy stupid, knowing Jones's taxi yeah. driver's got a point.
Well, the prices are too high. I think it's remarkable how well Trump has done with women.
Mm-hmm.
I was in Butler in Pennsylvania a couple of weeks ago. And one of the things I often do when I am on holiday is go and seek out politicos. And I was it was actually one of those fall harvest sort of festivals. They take autumn really seriously over there. They had loads and loads of pumpkins, and they also had a Republican and Democrat stand at this place. Now, Butler, of course, is the place that Trump had the attempted assassination. Mm-hmm. Pennsylvania is also, you know, one of the most significant swing states for the election as a whole. So they were throwing so much money at the campaign over there. So they had these big, big banners. And there was a huge stand just for Republicans for women. And I went over and started talking to them and say, oh, you know, I'm British. Hello. What are you guys up to? And they just couldn't stop talking about the fact that they didn't vote for Trump at the last election, but this year felt as though they just felt compelled to. They felt as though their family values are being attacked. This kind of suburban, the kind of belt region where effectively so many of those particular families, stay-at-home mums, mm-hmm. the kind of middle of the road woman that isn't necessarily a city girl in New York City or indeed doing incredibly successfully well financially. That is that kind of middle of the road, normal woman that has children. That kind of person has completely been alienated by Kamala Harris's campaign.
No, absolutely. And I think it would be one thing, Chris, if Trump had sort of squeaked it, then it would be easy to say this is purely because of the inflation. This is purely because of the sort of issues that loads of incumbent governments are facing. But the fact that he's the first Republican president to win the popular vote for 20 years, you know, and to do that from a position of being portrayed day in, day out as literally the reincarnation of Adolf Hitler.
Mm.
It's a hell of an achievement, if nothing else.
Possibly the comparisons of Hitler are starting to wear a little bit thin yeah. in the world of politics now. I don't really have
people the just sting ignore it now. Like it's yeah, like wallpaper, like, oh, don't be stupid. And then you sort of move on. But it has been dispiriting.
Yeah, like 20 years ago, if someone had told me that, oh, there's this politician somewhere, he's a fascist, yeah. I'd be like, oh my God, that's awful. And now I just assume that they're just conservative. Yeah.
We should, we're fast running out of time. So we should move on to back to our beat on this podcast, some of the nanny state stories that you wanted to talk about this week, Chris. Should we talk a bit about the tobacco and vapes bill? Labour's version of it has yeah. been introduced in the House of Commons this week. Much of it is similar, I suppose, to
identical.
What the Tories proposed. But do you want to talk us through what's in it, what's not in it? Because there have been a few things that were originally brief, which don't seem to have made it out into the final piece of legislation.
I haven't read the whole thing. I will hold my hands up. Right, it's quite a long document. It's very, very similar. I mean, nearly all the stuff that will matter to people is the same. They are consulting on standardised packaging for all tobacco products, which basically just means cigars, as far as I can tell, because I think cigars are the only things that are not in plain packaging. Mm-hmm. So they think that's going to move the dial on underage smoking if cigars yeah. are now in.
It's a big problem.
How many underage teens are drinking whiskey and smoking cigars?
And other than that, there are some bells and whistles that have been kind of proposed, not, I don't think, strictly speaking, in the bill, but are going to be consulted on. So there is talk, because he has kind of U-turned on the outdoor smoking ban in beer gardens and outside pubs,
mm-hmm.
he wants to ban smoking outside hospitals, which kind of is banned, but not legally in yeah. England, although it is in Scotland. And it's well known for being a ban that is widely flouted
mm-hmm.
because people don't really like walking out onto the street out of the entire grounds in their pajamas to have a cigarette. So that's going to be illegal. And I think like around kids' playgrounds and outside schools and stuff, fairly trivial, I guess. There is talk of banning vaping in some outdoor places as well. I'm not quite sure why. And even a suggestion of banning it indoors. It has been suggested, although again, it's not in legislation that, you know, wherever you can't smoke, you should be banned from vaping. Mm. That would be the hill I'm going to die on. Mm. And of course, the rest of it is the same. It's the prohibition for people who are 15 years or under now from ever buying tobacco products. All the various tobacco products that were in before are still in it, including things like Rizzlers and pipes themselves and anything that can encase tobacco and shisha ream, which I know you're very passionate about. Yeah. So it's all the same rubbish, but just a bit worse, which is kind of how life is, isn't it?
There we go.
Well, in the outdoor smoking ban, I'm so glad has been repealed because I wrote this piece for Spiked that effectively, if it was to be implemented in the way that they were proposing and the way that the media were reporting, what would genuinely happen is that every single shisha lounge in the country would have to shut down. Now, the indoor smoking ban effectively meant that shisha lounges had to adapt, and they managed to do so quite well. They kind of had these hybrid outdoor-indoor spaces that meant that they kind of teetered across the edge of the law, but they were able to get away with it. Mm-hmm. The outdoor smoking ban would have completely prohibited all of those particular businesses, often which are, you know, family-owned businesses. We're talking about the entirety of Edgware Road here, being completely shut down. So I'm quite happy that that's been repealed. But the arguments for the generational tobacco ban are still the same as they always have been. It's effectively this idea that the best way to get the next generation of young people off of tobacco and off of combustible products is to take it away from them legally. Now, again, this all sort of rests on the idea that because the government bans something, it's completely off the market. Mm-hmm. That's just not what happens. I honestly don't know one person that smokes that buys all of their tobacco legally anymore. Mm-hmm. Yeah, doing it. We're already buying tobacco illegally. Every time I travel, we'll buy duty-free products. There is no reason that somebody at the moment with the current level of tax and the current level of regulation that somebody would buy tobacco products legally unless they're terribly afraid of the black market. We know what's going to happen when tobacco is prohibited. Mm-hmm. It's going to effectively, the government have two choices, and we all have two choices as a society. Either tobacco is provided by a taxed and regulated private sector, or it's provided by criminal gangs. There is absolutely no third option in which it's provided by nobody. And you wrote a good piece in The Critic, Chris, about the Australian situation with firebombing. And effectively, when we're talking about the tobacconists and the fact that a lot of those retailers, the boss man, local corner shop bloke, is literally going to have their life threatened and their business is threatened as a result of...
People died,
People have died as a result of this war on tobacco.
The Australian thing is amazing, and it should be in the papers a lot more in this country. The Times actually mentioned it today, which I was pleased to see, but it's not getting much coverage. It's getting lots of coverage in Australia because it's happening all the time. There have been about 140 firebombings now, or arson attacks, or ram raids of some sort of tobacconists, and everybody there accepts that this is because we have stupidly high tobacco prices. They haven't banned tobacco. They haven't got the generational ban. They've just got such high tobacco prices that for a lot of people, it might as well be banned. Plus, they have actually literally banned vapes of all types. And, you know, people like, well, all three of us were making arguments against these kind of neo-prohibitionist policies will say this is going to fuel the black market.
Yeah.
And they generally do. It's just that it happens quite quietly, but by its nature, the black market is kind of under the radar. So we don't see it expanding, and the government's made no attempt for years to try and measure it properly. You know,
didn't the Tories actively reject the idea that it would fuel the black market at all, the generational ban? They were just like, oh, there's no...
Yeah, Neil LeBron said, no, it won't. And we're not going to do an impact assessment because it just won't. And none of the stuff we've ever done in the past has fueled it. And here's a graph showing it. But the graph is just made up. They're not making any attempt to measure the size of the black market. To give you an example of what I mean, legal cigarette sales, which we can track, have declined by 30% in 2 years. Now, if the smoking rate had gone down by 30%, you go, well, that's fair enough. It hasn't. It's gone down by 10%, if that. So clearly, it's pretty obvious what's going on there, because the smokers are not smoking fewer cigarettes. They're actually smoking slightly more cigarettes, according to the ONS. So that gap is obviously comprised of black market sales. But like I say, you can't see it, and so it doesn't tend to get a lot of attention. But in Australia, because you've got tobacco and it's literally going up in flames several times a week, you can't ignore it anymore. So this is not some kind of scare story that, you know, tobacco market can descend into sort of Al Capone type problems. This is actually happening in quite a similar country, albeit on the other side of the world. You can use this. This is proof of concept. Mm-hmm. Why are we doing this? Yeah.
I mean, to try and look forward with a bit more of an optimistic fashion, Reem, do you think because of what Chris has just said, because of the fact that this is actually a much more drastic and in some respects unprecedented move to try and prohibit a product which is widely and legally available currently and has been consumed in this country for a very long time, you've got the Australian example, you've got New Zealand, which decided to junk a similar policy because they realised how batshit crazy it was and really difficult to enforce. We have already seen things like the smoking in beer gardens peel away because of just a recognition of too much of a headache is. Could you see more of these measures falling by the wayside, at least a few of them, as a consequence of how ill thought through all of this is?
If Parliament are able to delay the legislation, then I think absolutely. The fact that the outdoor smoking ban wasn't included in the final piece of legislation, I think does show that there is an appetite for listening to at least some people. The disposable vapes ban came from DEFRA, not from the Department of Public Health.
Yeah.
So the environmental arguments around disposable vapes are effectively what meant that they included that in their bans. I think it's important to be making the public health arguments as well. The fact that, you know, it's a noble cause to want to reduce smoking rates. We all know that smoking is bad for us. I know every time I light a cigarette that it's very bad for me, but I still choose to do so anyway. The best way to reduce smoking rates, and the only country in the world that has actually achieved what we might call smoke-free, which is an adult smoking population of less than 5%, is Sweden. Not by banning tobacco, not by telling adults what they can and cannot do with their own bodies, but by actually allowing adults to choose safer and healthier products. But I remember Chris saying...
So snus in their case.
So snus. And you know, the UK used to be a world leader, literally a world leader in tobacco harm reduction. Adults were switching to vaping and they were much, much better off for it. But I do remember Chris once saying to me, you know, we make all these public health arguments, but ultimately, if we don't make the argument that adults should be allowed to do what they want from a first principles basis, they will use the public health arguments against you. And I remember you said, I mean, Chris, you've been talking about this for so long. I'm not calling you old, but you have been talking about this for so long. And you know, the fact that these public health arguments are there are absolutely valid. And I make them all the time. But we have to be very clear. The reason why this is a really terrible policy is also because of all the consequentialist arguments. It's also because there will be a huge level of black market products available, that we might see our local boss man get killed by a firebomb, but also because it is fundamentally the government taking away a choice from adults, and it's hugely illiberal and fundamentally flawed.
Yep. The thing that it's only a small thing in a way, but one thing that really annoys me about this generational ban is the idea that in 20 years' time, some guy can get married and not buy a cigar to smoke. We're not talking about someone chain-smoking cigarettes. Just decide, oh, let's have a nice cigar now and again, New Year's Eve or something like that. Mm-hmm. No, he can't do it. I can because I'm older than you, but you can't. Mm-hmm. It just seems so petty and unfair. You know, even if they stripped out everything but cigarettes, it would be a little bit less ridiculous and vindictive.
It's kind of
it's going to happen, let's face it. There's no way it's not going to happen. They've got a massive majority. There's not really any bunch of off from the Labour.
But it does also, I think, last time I checked, the Tory wipeout has disproportionately hit the people who were the smoking ban rebels.
Yeah.
For all kinds of specific geographical reasons, I'm sure. But people don't seem to appreciate how culturally grim this is. Like, just that general attitude of health isn't the most important thing, live and let live. What they do is none of your business. Like, that's just that does not figure at all in this discussion. You know, we could get into highfalutin arguments about people's bodily autonomy and so on, but even just on that kind of low level,
let people do what they want.
Get out of my lifetime. It just doesn't register.
Well, Chris Whitty has been the face of it. Did you see his little video?
No, I didn't.
A few days ago, he turned up in an ill-fitting suit, looking as cheerful as ever.
Mm. Yeah. Life and soul of the party.
He's exactly who you want to regulate your lifestyle. I'd love to have Chris Whitty's joyful lifestyle. And he turned up and he went through his usual spiel. Smoking kills 80,000 people a year. And the people say this is about freedom of choice, but once you start smoking, you're hooked and your freedom is taken away. It's not really, is it? I mean, firstly, there are, as Reem's already said, other ways of taking nicotine.
Yeah.
Masses these days, loads of ways of taking nicotine. If you don't like the pouches and the vaping or the heated tobacco or whatever, then you obviously prefer smoking, so carry on smoking. Mm-hmm. That should be the carry on smoking. You see that film? It's good. And
another one from your youth.
But the other thing is, according to the latest statistics, 71% of all the people in Britain who have ever smoked are now non-smokers.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not saying nicotine isn't addictive at all, but clearly for some people it's not very addictive whatsoever. We all know social smokers. Most of the younger people, I don't mean kids, but younger people who vape only do so occasionally. So they're clearly not hooked on nicotine, as people would have you believe. If the a large majority of people have given who have ever smoked have given up smoking, I don't think you can really say that their freedom has been taken away. Yeah. And the only way we can give it back to them is by banning them from buying products. This is just Orwellian doublespeak, as far as I can see. Oh, the real freedom is not to be allowed to do this. You know?
And that's what's so strange, to see this argument mounted on behalf of the younger generation who are really not smoking. I mean, that's one thing that the vaping statistics are bandied around so much, because almost to cover up for the fact that teenage smoking has basically fallen off.
It's collapsed, especially since the disposable turned up, actually.
Well, it's the thing with disposables. I mean, effectively, if you're looking at the arguments across the board, and this is something that, so Chris and I wrote a paper called A Vapid Solution almost a year ago, specifically about the disposable vapes ban. And ASH, Action on Smoking and Health, literally published these statistics. Double the number of 11 to 17 year olds drink alcohol regularly, drink alcohol regularly than vape regularly. But no one is saying we should ban alcohol for everyone, because people that are already banned from buying that product managed to get their hands on it. I mean,
Chris Whitty will probably be saying that in 10 years.
Well, indeed. But the fact that the basis for this legislation is that we don't want kids to vape. Okay, well, it's already illegal for kids to vape. So we don't want kids to vape. So we're going to take it away from every single adult in the country because we don't want kids to vape, even though it's already illegal for kids to vape. It's absolutely absurd. The fact that the existing legislation isn't being enforced. But let's be very clear about the reality of this. It's just not going to happen. Like, we're still going to be importing disposable vapes. I reckon I could just as easily get a disposable, maybe even more easily, get a disposable vape after the ban than I can at the moment. You go into any corner shop in London, you'll see the 5,000 puffs. And these are technically illegal.
Yeah.
They're imported illegally, and you can just as easily get them. You can more easily get them than any other tobacco product, any other nicotine product.
Because what is the proportion of the market which is basically already black market for vapes? Isn't it some?
They reckon it's about a third.
Yeah,
certainly for the disposables, which I can well believe. Mm-hmm. And that's a really easy thing to crack down on. You literally, if you change standards, you just go into a shop and, like Bloom says, if it's got 5,000 puffs to it, then it's more than 2 mil of liquid in it, which is de facto illegal, or de jure illegal for that matter. But they don't. There's no one seems to be knocking around.
There's no enforcement. No. The fact that they think the solution is more less legislation, which will quite possibly
harm people's increase
lives,
the black market.
But also, just any time you make it more difficult for adult smokers to quit smoking, you are making it more difficult to quit smoking. You are harming people's lives. So the fact that we think the solution is more legislation and not just enforcing the current laws that we already have, it's already illegal for kids to vape or to smoke. The fact that they think that the best way to do this is to effectively provide more legislation that they obviously can't enforce. Mm-hmm. Like, we're not enforcing the current ones. What makes them think they can enforce the new ones?
Many such cases.
So the disposable vapes ban, as I understand, it's coming in June next year.
Yeah, next June.
Under environmental law.
And then there's a bloody vape tax. We haven't mentioned the vape tax.
Should we talk a bit more about the rest of the kind of vape-related restrictions this demented policy of trying to crack down on smoking at the very time you're trying to crack down on the...
They're doing a vape tax, right? This is my... this is not good for a podcast, but this is my bottle of vape. It's 10 mils, listeners, which is the largest you can get thanks to the EU for some ridiculous
bubble
reason.
Bubble gum, chocolate chip,
that
something or other.
That cost me about £2.50. The tax on this is going to be £2.20, plus VAT, I would assume. So the tax will actually be more than the price of the product. Mm-hmm. And you can get liquid cheaper than that. You can get liquid 99p. So for some people, you're looking at least trebling the cost of vaping. And the government said, we're going to put a 60p a pack tax on fags to make sure that people don't go back to smoking. That's not how it works. Ridiculous. Apart from anything else, like we've already discussed, a lot of people are not paying the legal price for a pack of cigarettes. The de facto price is £5, right? And that's going to stay at £5. That's inflation busting the black market Manchester's at £5. This is going to be now well over £5 for a bottle of vape juice. And it's personally annoying because it means I'm going to have to spend another £300 or £400 a year giving money to a government that holds me in contempt, and vice versa.
It's not great. It's I think that the fundamental point we have to make here is that every time we make it more expensive to vape, we're making it more difficult for adults to quit smoking.
But the real point is I'm going to have to spend another £300 or £400. That's the issue here.
Because your behaviour will not change as a consequence of these.
I'm not arguing about these things. Why should I have to pay more money? I won't as well. I'll tell you, I will not. You can get a litre of it from China very quickly. It's unflavoured anyway, so
Cute. You vape the unflavored.
Yeah, I'm future proofing myself against further regulation.
So you're getting yourself sort of used to the unflavored stuff.
Yeah, I want refillable with unflavored. I thought it was safe. I didn't think there was going to be a vape tax coming in.
We're also potentially looking at some restrictions on flavors as well. Yeah. So I think that's also an important point to make, that effectively the government, well, again, this all comes down to we don't want vaping to be attractive to children. So we're just going to restrict the amount of flavors. There's an organization called the World Vapors Alliance, and they have a really great jumper that I once took from them that says adults like flavors too. Mm-hmm. And it's just absolutely true. I mean, adults do like flavors too. I love a candy floss flavored vape, but also, like, more fundamentally, it helps. I mean, Chris hates it when I'm making these public health arguments, but I mean,
well, one more, if you must.
Adults using flavors, it means that they get themselves taken off of the tobacco taste, and actually they become more used to the flavors with vaping. There is so much evidence to show that it's much easier for adults to quit smoking and switch to vaping when they are introduced to flavors. Mm-hmm. So again, the government taking that away is making it more difficult to quit smoking.
So so-called tobacco flavor tastes disgusting.
Yes.
Most people don't like it. Why should you be restricted to something that is supposed to taste like tobacco but actually doesn't?
Yeah.
Why allow that one particular flavour?
You'd rather have a real tobacco, real cigarette.
Let's face it, they want us to start smoking again. It's the only explanation.
They want us to die earlier so they don't have to pay our pensions.
Chris Whitty is a tobacco industry plant.
He's deep.
deep undercover.
Yeah.
Chris, are you at all heartened by the fact that when this kind of string of announcements, I guess particularly the outdoor smoking ban, or the pub garden smoking ban, I should say, which has already seemingly hit the cutting room floor, there was a lot more discussion about this than previously. Maybe because it kind of knitted in with a general sense that the government was authoritarian and miserable and Keir Starmer was already pretty unpopular. But it does feel like these nanny state issues are a bit more of a live discussion, maybe, than they were in
the recent
past. I
think that's probably because the right-wing press... I can use it as a stick to beat Labour. I mean, there isn't very much actually Labour have done that the Tories weren't planning on doing.
Mm-hmm.
And Rishi Sunak was getting a relatively easy ride when he was talking about doing it. So I think there's a party political element to it. And with the outdoor smoking ban, fortunately, people kind of didn't see this as a sort of big tobacco versus the government thing, mm-hmm. which they often do, even with vaping. They saw this as the pub trade, which is struggling, versus overreaching government. Which helps because people are much more sympathetic, obviously, to pubs than they are to tobacco companies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the party political point is really important, that actually now that the Conservatives are in opposition, they're now saying, well, we weren't going to go that far with all this stuff. And it really is like that. I had a unnamed Conservative Member of Parliament who was on the Tobacco and Vapes Bill Committee, who voted for the legislation, mm-hmm. and we'll remind ourselves that everybody on the committee were people that supported the legislation in the first place. Mm-hmm. And he said, God, Reem, can you believe this outdoor smoking ban? And I was like, I mean, how different is this kind of policy from what you supported?
Yeah, prohibition. Yeah, you just wanted to prohibit the sale.
You just wanted to prohibit the sale. And you're saying,
in a sense, they would have created that in time.
It would have been illegal for people to smoke outside, mm-hmm. inside, and in their own homes. But it's so funny that there is this party political point. I actually think it does bode well. In our favour, mm-hmm. where those of us that are pro-freedom on these arguments. But also the fact that Kemi Badenoch, now the leader of the Conservative Party, when she was asked during the election campaign, what is the most unconservative thing that your party has done? She said the generational tobacco ban.
Yep.
Now, I don't know how performative that is or if she genuinely believes it, but I think that there is an element here that the Conservative Party might be moving maybe I'm being too optimistic, young and optimistic and naive, but maybe the Conservative Party is moving in a more pro-freedom direction. And then the fact that the leader of the Conservative Party, the leader of the opposition, is now saying that this stuff is unconservative and is illiberal does move the right-wing press in that way, and it means that we are talking about these nanny state issues in a much more constructive fashion.
I might be making this up, but didn't a lot of the other would-be leadership candidates either vote against that legislation or abstain?
No,
like, even Penny Mordaunt, I've got in my head for some reason, maybe tried to signal that she wasn't happy with it. To your point, it does seem like the wind's blowing a bit more in that direction, Chris,
yeah,
maybe.
I don't know. Yeah, you might be right. It's a shame they only got 121 MPs, can't really do anything about anything.
But they can make a lot more noise now that they are in opposition, mm-hmm. and it seems that they are much more receptive to the pro-liberty arguments on lifestyle issues.
We can only hope. I've completely forgotten about the Tory leadership, given the last 24 hours. Why are they deciding to hold it 2 days before the US presidential election? They would have had a lot more time to dominate the headlines. We're fast running out of time. So, Reem, last question of the show, as always, If you had to have one ban, what would it be? It's got to be separate to the one that you chose last time, which has completely fallen out of my memory at this point.
I totally forgot what I chose last time. Oh, no, I said slow walkers last time.
There we go.
Another
popular choice. So if you want to add a ban, what would you like to pick?
Oh, men in crop tops.
Yep.
Men in crop tops. Fair enough. I don't see many of them. But,
yeah. You do, and it's just not a good look.
Chris, any thoughts on men in crop tops? I mean, you are wearing one at the moment. I can see it underneath that.
Yeah, Chris actually has his entire stomach out and he's about to and rock and belly dance.
Which is not true, listeners. wearing very normal clothes. And I cannot disagree with what Rim said. Well, certainly slow walkers. Mm-hmm. Which is a theme, isn't it, with all these bands? Yeah. Most people go for things that annoy them on the pavements of London.
Yeah.
Or anywhere.
There is a...
Someone needs to do... Why doesn't the government do something about that?
Yeah.
The slow walkers and wheelie suitcase bill rather than the tobacco and vape bill.
You could slowly phase it out over many, many years. You know.
Yeah, loads of them at Victoria Station today. They stand there. They get off the train and they stand there with it. Just move at least. It's wheelie. The whole point is you move with it. Then they've got to stand there and... It's too big because it weighs twice as much as they do and they can't get it out.
And so it's always a little, very, very little woman
with a bag bigger than her. And it's fine until you get to the flight of stairs and then it's completely snookered.
The suitcase thing, maybe I think it's just you prime me to follow it, but the suitcase thing is getting crazy. You see people getting on.
No, I'm good.
With like four or five of these things.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like it's going to take a few people to step up and intervene themselves. The state is not going to take an interest in this.
We need some social action against people on the tube with large amounts of suitcases.
Vigilantes.
On that note, Chris, really, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
You've been listening to Last Orders. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Please do take a moment to leave us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to support the show, why not become a Spiked supporter? Just go to spiked-online.com/supporters to sign up. That's spiked-online.com/supporters.